Good morning. This is Brian Trumbore with your week in review for Saturday, November 14th. It was a light week for economic and corporate data. Next week, though, we have all manner of releases on housing inflation and retail sales and a bit more clarity, perhaps, on where we're headed. All I'll say for now is I have a very hard time agreeing with the bulls that the Christmas shopping season is going to surprise to the upside. I'll go with flat versus last year's dismal effort at best. What we did learn the past few days, however, was that while Europe has broken the back of its recession, growth in the 16-nation Eurozone came in at just 0.4% for the third quarter, with Germany up 0.7%, France up 0.3%, and Italy up 0.6%, all falling short of expectations. In the UK, though, the Bank of England said it sees a solid recovery on the horizon, with 2% growth in 2010 and 4% in 2011. So as the girl sings in Meatloaf's Paradise by the dashboard light, what's it gonna be, boy? A rousing recovery, or do we just limp along? At least Asia continues to plow ahead, thanks to China, which this week reported both industrial production and retail sales surge 16% for the month of October, while inflation as measured by the Consumer Price Index sagged 0.5%, though at least the deflationary trend here appears to be lessening. For its part, Japan had some good news with leading indicator machine tool orders rising 10% in September. Can't manufacture a lot of new products without the right tools, my father always said. Actually, he never said such a thing, but work with me. One item in Asia that wasn't so great was the GDP figure for the quarter in Hong Kong, expected to be up 2.2%, but instead only up 0.4%. Hong Kong is wrestling with its property bubble. So that's your quick tour around the world as we hop on our UAL flight from London to Chicago to get back into U.S. mode. But what's this? The pilot's drunk? Well, that's kind of the way we all were during the height of the bubble. Well, next week will supply us with further data on the current situation in housing. Luxury builder Toll Brothers did say it saw a surge in orders, a good thing, and Zillow.com reported it sees fewer homes in negative equity in the third quarter over the second, which is a further sign of stability. But then you continue to have this drumbeat that the next big shoe to drop is commercial real estate, or CRE. And on this topic, I have been consistent in my stance, as I have on everything else regarding both real estate and the equity markets, quite frankly. I've been saying commercial real estate would have little, if any, impact on the equity markets, despite all the doom and gloom, and that has indeed been the case. We've continued to rally. This was an easy call to make, even as many seem to ignore it, because you and I don't talk about CRE at the cocktail party or tailgate like we do the crash in residential. It's about the wealth effect. You felt the collapse in housing, but while you may notice some empty new office buildings or an anchor tenant that has left your mall, it's no skin off your nose to be blunt about it. You're more worried about your own financial condition. But of course, the problems in CRE directly impact these small and medium-sized banks in particular, and as they attempt to deal with all the bad loans, particularly of the construction variety on their books, they are far less apt to have the ability to give you a loan or that small business in the center of town. It's retrenchment time, and many banks are just struggling to survive, with 115 or more collapsing in 2009 thus far. So the issue of commercial real estate is a story about the pace of any overall economic recovery and the possibilities of a double dip, but thus far it has not impacted the stock market one iota. As Federal Reserve Bank President Dennis Lockhart said in a CNBC interview this week, CRE is a headwind but not a showstopper. Just a few other items. President Obama said he would hold a jobs summit in December. I hope he listens to German Chancellor Angela Merkel, who announced that despite the risk to the country's fiscal condition, she is nonetheless plowing ahead with tax cuts for business and the consumer. If we do it right, Merkel said, we will give Germany new strength. You go, girl. Then there's healthcare. We have weeks before wrapping this topic up, one way or another, in terms of potential legislation as the Senate now takes up what the House passed by the narrowest of margins, 220 to 215, with 39 Democrats against, one Republican for. The Congressional Budget Office says the Pelosi special ensures $36 million more at a cost of $1.2 trillion the first 10 years. But Senator Joe Lieberman, an independent, has said all along he would not accept any health care bill that contained a public option, so if Lieberman bails, the Democrats can't get the required 60 votes. For now, understand it will be a Christmas miracle for Obama to have something to sign on his desk before the holidays. On the Christmas Hanukkah shopping season front, Macy's and Kohl's weren't exactly glowing with optimism in their forecast this week, but Kohl's did expect it to be constructive, a word you can drive a truck through. But FedEx was rather upbeat. Gold continued to hit new highs, even as the dollar has basically stabilized the past few weeks, though you'd never know it from the breathless talking heads. But if you don't think we're near or at the top, just look at your TV set. I was very distressed to see two of my favorite New York Mets, Ron Darling and Ed Cranepool, doing a new commercial for something called U.S. Coins. Oh, brother. Investment advice from the Mets. To paraphrase Jackie DeShannon, this is not what the world needs now. Or another new commercial that appeared just this week, this on top of the 100 others with the likes of role model G. Gordon Liddy, a classy-looking dame with a British accent who asked, "If I give you $50,000 in cash or $50,000 in gold for the next 5 years, which would you choose?" "Me? Cash. I'd then do something with it. Maybe put $10,000 in each of 5 stocks. Or go to Richard Branson's Necker Island for some real fun and worried about what I'd do with the rest of my life when I get back. But I digress. The inference the classy dame is making is, of course, that gold will outperform stocks. So now you know how we're told correctly that stocks have been a dead investment the past 10 years, right? But do you remember where the Dow Jones was when gold was hitting the 800 level back in 1980? Try about 900 on average that year. The Dow is now over 10,000. It took gold 29 years to go from 800 to 1100. Just a thought. I know a few broker, financial planner friends who might use this. Now, if you're looking to gold as a hedge for geopolitical reasons, as I keep noting the past few months, good. Nothing wrong with that. Just understand why you're buying it. I can certainly give you one good reason on this end. Iran. So as I predicted months ago that Israel would bomb Iran's nuclear facility or facilities in November, and we only have 2 weeks left in the month, what's the latest on this front? Let me make a few points. Iran has yet to formally respond to the proposal put forward by the G5 plus 1 to send its enriched uranium to Russia for further enrichment for medical use. What the Iranian government has said instead is that it's not real keen on the proposal, this after its negotiator said it sounded good to him. What Iran did offer, informally, was that it would buy the needed 20% enriched uranium and keep its own. A non-starter with the U.S. at all, to say the least. Iran warned Russia that if Moscow didn't deliver the S-300 anti-aircraft missile defense system for which Russia signed a contract 2 years ago, then relations between Iran and Russia would be harmed. So I take you back to the Week in Review, October 10th of this year, where I wrote the following. I still maintain that Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu told Vladimir Putin and Dmitry Medvedev that Israel was going to be forced to act and that if Russia would just delay delivery on the S-300 sophisticated anti-missile system it has promised Tehran, Israel wouldn't stand in the way of any future Russian arms deals once Israel has done its work. Just a thought, my own, not anyone else's. So that's what I wrote last October 10th. So my theory hasn't been disproved yet. The U.S. accused Iran and the U.N. Security Council of arms deliveries to Hezbollah through Syria, following Israel's seizure of hundreds of tons of weapons aboard a ship headed for Syria. Hezbollah's Sheikh Nasrallah warned Israel it better not launch a preemptive strike on Lebanon, Nasrallah offering that this would come before a strike on Iran. I don't see it happening this way, but regardless, should Israel strike, it will be prepared to act virtually simultaneously against what would be a certain Hezbollah counterattack directed from Tehran. There is little doubt, however, that Hezbollah has hardened its defenses since the 2006 war. A follow-up, Iran's parliament gave President Ahmadinejad an apparent victory by giving him a free hand to spend extra oil revenues as he sees fit. I wrote last time this was in dispute and a source of tension. The government now intends to open bank accounts for 36 million people, about half the population, to give them cash to compensate for higher food and energy prices. Federal authorities moved to seize U.S. assets controlled by suspected terror organizations linked to Iran, including various mosques and a Manhattan skyscraper, all of which were supposedly connected to an Iran bank that has been identified as a key financier of Tehran's missile programs and acts of terrorism. The Obama administration deserves credit on this one. The New York-based organization known as the Alavi Foundation has been under surveillance for decades, but at least action was finally taken. It also takes guts because, as the Council on American-Islamic Relations said after, the seizure of American houses of worship could have a chilling effect on the religious freedom of citizens of all faiths and may send a negative message to Muslims worldwide, to which I say, too bad. This week, Iran also accused three detained Americans of spying, meaning a probable show trial is now on the docket, and Iran lashed out at Oxford University for establishing a scholarship in the name of Nida Saleyaga Sultan, the young woman gunned down in the post-election protest last June. Iran's embassy in London said Oxford was now linked to interference in Iran's internal affairs. Too bad we can't settle the whole conflict with a debate between Oxford and Iran's cavemen. I think you'd agree it would be rather one-sided, as long as the Iranian debaters weren't allowed to take a four-year break to enrich uranium in a bathroom. Lastly, I hope some of you caught the action at the White House this past Monday night, or rather, read about it, because no pictures or press were allowed. Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu met with President Obama for 2 hours. "It was a very focused and very positive conversation," said Netanyahu after. "This conversation dealt with a range of subjects that are important for the security of Israel and for our joint efforts to advance peace," he added. Netanyahu refused to elaborate, saying only, "I think this visit will turn out to have been very important." Obama said nothing. I read a lot of different accounts, and shockingly, they all focused on the Israeli-Palestinian issue. That is inconceivable. Of course the focus was Iran. It had to be. It's certainly the only thing on Netanyahu's mind these days. The talk of restarting negotiations with the Palestinians is nothing more than a smokescreen, which Palestinian President Abbas has finally figured out. So what were Obama and Netanyahu doing? War gaming? Think back to Netanyahu's secret trip to Moscow. You know, a curious thing happened this week on Bill O'Reilly's show. He had a liberal professor, Dr. Mark Lamont Hill, substituting for Alan Colmes' slot, and the topic was Iran. Dr. Hill was like, "Oh sure, Iran has had their chance, it's time for military action." This coming from a guy on the far left. To me, it signals an important change in attitude. Much has been made of President Obama the past few days, as first put forward in a Washington Post piece, that he is really feeling the strains of the office and that he's lost a lot of weight, if this was even possible. Clearly, the Afghan troop decision is weighing on him, but it would be the height of naivety to believe Iran isn't right up there as well. It's even more worrisome because of all that we just don't know. Turning to Wall Street, consumer confidence continues to drop, but the sentiment on Wall Street only got better as the Dow Jones, S&P 500, and NASDAQ all surged an additional 2% this week on the heels of solid earnings news from the likes of Disney and Hewlett-Packard, the latter, HP, also making a big acquisition, 3Com. Disney's report talked of a slight increase in attendance as theme parks, another good sign for the economy as well. Overall, 80% of the companies in the S&P 500 have exceeded analysts' expectations this reporting period, the highest ratio according to Bloomberg since 1993. But aside from the fact I'm urging extreme caution due to the Iranian situation, but not an outright sell as yet, I can't ignore valuations. And if you tell me the S&P 500 will earn $75 next year, then we're not overvalued. But neither do we have much further to run, maybe 5%. If you tell me we're going to earn $80 in 2010, tack on another 10% or so. But let's see what happens the next few weeks with regards to activity at the malls as well as the geopolitical landscape. That's all for this week. I'll be back with you next Saturday, November 21st. And for further information, check out the Week in Review column at stocksandnews.com. Have a great week.